There's a bit of participation that I'll be asking you to do in a short while. Obviously, that will work or not work if you do or don't participate. Obviously, we'll see in a moment how that goes. I've decided to contextualise this because clearly there's a huge amount to say about the Bible and structure and justice. So what rather I've done is to think about a particular passage and to look at that passage in light of two scholars. First one is a guy called William Herzog, who a number of years a book that some of you will be familiar with, which is The Parables as Subversive Speech. The Parables as Subversive Speech by William Herzog III. I'm always amused by Americans' notions that children should not have their own names. But even so, William Herzog III, The Parables of Subversive Speech. The other resource I'm drawing on is by an African-American black theologian called Dwight Hopkins. And a number of years ago, he co-edited a book called Religions and Globalization. Religions and Globalization. It's about 2004, 2005. And in that, Hopkins has an essay where he talks about the theology of, and he describes it as neoliberal monopoly capitalism. The religion of neoliberal monopoly capitalism. And if you don't remember anything else about what I'm going to say, then remember this, that the system that we have that is given to us as normative is not the kingdom of God. It's important to state that, because actually part of its power is, certainly since the demise of the communist bloc, and we've had that famous book by Fukuyama, The End of History, is that somehow the triumph of capitalism is to be equated with God's will, and this is what the world should be. And we have colluded with that historically, the church, particularly in the global north, because actually the rise of capitalism in all its various forms has the church deeply implicated in that. To the point whereby what we often do is read the Gospels in a normative fashion to remind ourselves that those of us who are on the right side of the victory of history, that this is God's will. So if you remember nothing else, is that what we're asked to do is to critique this and say this is not the kingdom. And so what I want to do is just offer you a parable and to reread that very quickly, in which I'm going to invite you to participate. So it's Matthew 25, 14 to 30, it's the parable of the talents. We all know the story. A master has three servants. He's going to go out and gives them some resources to work with. First one he gives three talents, second one he gives two, one he gives one. And the first one works really hard and makes money for the master. Second one works, is not as successful. The third one, of course, is clearly the villain. That's what most of us grew up with. Here's the villain. All he does is stick it in the ground, gives it back to the master and says, here. Important to note that the master's not any less worse off, because he's gotten back that which he gave him. But of course, there's this denunciation of his laziness and his slothfulness, and he's punished. And the key thing that, even when I was a kid, I could never quite get my head around, is that last bit where it says, and to those who have been given much, more shall be given. And to those who have little, even the little they have, will be taken from them. And we all kind of read that. I'm in church and I thought, that doesn't sound right. Those that have much will get more. And those in the little they have, will be taken from them. But of course, what the church always did was spiritualize it. Say, well, of course, this has nothing to do with money. It's about gifts and talents. It's about hard work. It's about thrift. And it's interesting that in the early part of the last century, an American president, of course all American presidents are Christians. It's interesting that all of them are kind of born again and the Christians, even like the dodgy ones, they're still Christians. That president in the early part of the last century, called Warren Harding, said that this was his favourite passage because it showed the truth of capitalism and hard work and thrift. The crime of the third one is the fact that he was just a lazy, shiftless person who made no effort. And therefore, and it's interesting that if you look at the disproportionate treatment of him, take what he has, he's damned and thrown into everlasting suffering. simply because he didn't make money. I mean, that seems a disproportionate bit of judgment, if you ask me. So, okay, so here's the participative bit. It's going to be very, very quickly done on the hoof. So those of you on roughly this side, you're the first servant who's been given the most resources. So it's important to note that the master himself does not treat people equally. We're told that he gives the resources according to their ability, but we've only got his word for it. So already there's a discrimination in terms of who gets what. So on this side, you're the first servant. And the simple question is, why do you do what you do? So you go out and you make money. But why are you doing it? So that's your first one. Roughly in the middle, and of course I'll let you decide which group you want to be in. So roughly in the middle, you're number two. So you've been given less resources. So the first question to be asked is, how do you feel about being given less than someone else? Because in the text, there's no comment upon even this disparity. We assume that the master is making a wise judgment because he knows the people. But like I said, we're asked to take that on trust. So very quickly, why do you do what you do? But this initial question is, but what do you think about the other person who has more than you, to start with? And on this side, you're number three, so clearly the emphasis is upon you to justify yourself, because you're like the lazy, shiftless, terrible people. You are the undeserving poor. And that's right, we'll get to that in a moment, because it's very interesting how we demonize those who don't do well, and it's their fault, because clearly the system is so beneficial that if you work hard enough, you do well. So clearly the ones who are not doing well, it's their fault. Think of the program of that benefit street that would be made in order to demonize the poor and make them look like they're the architects of their own misfortune. So you're on this side, you've got a lot of justifying to do here. Why is it that you're such lazy bastards? Why is it that you're not doing the thing you should be doing? But again, how do you feel being given the least of all the resources that we're going? So very quickly, just turn to each other, and why do you do what you do? And I'll get back to you in a few minutes. Okay, folks, if I could bring you back very quickly. So, on this side, servant number one, why do you do what you do?
Freedom from fear.
Freedom from fear. So you fear the master.
No.
No.
Freer from fear.
Yeah.
Because I get that. You are exposed to less risk.
Yeah.
And therefore.
Okay.
You can go.
But whilst I'm here, do you like the master?
Yeah.
You do? Okay. And you like him because? Yes, giving me more. Well, that's an obvious reason to like it. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you feel affirmed because he's given you
money. Yeah. Okay. Second group. So why do you do what you do? But firstly, what do you think about those other folk?
I'm going to ask the question, did we know that the others got more or less?
That's a good question.
I asked the question, do we know that the others got more or less? Because if we know, that massively impacts how we feel about it.
Yeah.
We saw it through kind of slavery angle.
Yeah.
The master and servitude.
Yeah.
And the death of slavery. And then you want fear of that the master has complete ownership and power over the individual. And there's one of them trying to win the favour of the master, the policeman, put fear on slavers. And the first servant is kind of actually a masculist and making discriminating servant narrative shameful.
Not very pleased with that lot.
Okay.
On the same number of holidays they're getting. But also something you kind of look at as the American dream, as the epitome. We'll just keep our heads down.
Yeah.
We're not there anymore.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We might be there one day, so we don't want to make a fuss.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
We couldn't quite decide on this table. I think we were between two kind of opinions.
one was, they're really pissed off with this lot because they don't want to share.
Yeah.
They're really sorry with that lot over there, so we kept wondering whether we should give, like, they got £3, we got £2, no quid. Should we give, like, 50 pence to them to make it a little bit better? But then we also thought we could actually support the master. And
say,
hey, folks over there, and hey, folks over there, can we all get together, pull our resources, and then see what happens?
That's a interesting perspective. On this side, very quickly. So
I think we've been quite fearful that we haven't got so much really. I don't see myself having much to do with them. You know, we've just got to look after this money. We're not going to risk it on anything. Like the master, I don't see myself as an investor. We have to do it. So we just buried it and hope for the best.
We've lost confidence because these guys have got three times as much, twice as much.
Yeah.
So there's that in the mind. However, perhaps I'm looking through this at this through 21st century Western eyes rather than first century Palestinian eyes. But maybe the boss is very clever. Maybe he's come to us on a quietly and said, "Look, you're three times better than that riffraff over there. I'm going to give you a lot less. But I think we've got
the
potential for building
another
one."
Yeah. For me.
But yes, also that our assessment of the master is absolutely correct. He is a vicious horse.
Yeah.
If we go back with anything less than the talent, he's going to sell us all in slavery.
Yeah.
And we're not going to put the money to the banks because we don't believe in use.
I think what I feel is that I'm not worthy.
Yeah.
I'm not worthy. They're clearly worthy of more than me. I mean, maybe I've done something wrong.
Yeah.
Our table has poverty of imagination.
Okay. So you're stuck in the ground. Yeah.
We didn't know what to do with it, so we did nothing.
Yeah, you did nothing. Thank you. Obviously, it's. There's always an element of speculation between ourselves and the text because we weren't there when the text was created. And whatever the merits of historical critical scholarship, of which there are many merits, but I think sometimes it oversells itself in terms of our ability to know a sense of authorial intention. So it's important to say that this is a reading, not a definitive. It's not the only way in which you can read this text. But I want to make a few very quick observations, then just give some time then for questions and responses. I think the most obvious thing I want to say from this, and to me it's obvious because we have a clue in the text, the master cannot be God. I mean, surely the master can't be God. And the reason we say that is because when the third servant turns to the master and says, "But I know that you're a hard person, you reap what you didn't sow," And the master never refused it. He didn't say, "Well, quite frankly, how dare you impugn me?" Let's face it, rich people are very quick to go to the courts when someone maligns them, either verbally or in print. Robert Maxwell made a whole history of suing people who wrote negative things about him. So it's interesting that the master never refutes this accusation that's made about him. He is indeed cruel. And it's certainly the case that the third servant, and maybe implied in the other two, are fearful of him because he is hard, he is cruel, and he's unjust. Interesting how, having seen that clearly in the text, we still assume it's God. What an interesting bit of theological sleight of hand suddenly happens that makes us see a master who clearly, at the very least, is discriminatory. At the very least is that. If not, a damn sight more than that. And somehow, we're asked to believe that this is God and the text is normative in terms of how God treats people and therefore how we should see people in terms of resources and their places within systems and structures. It's interesting how we've been almost conned, I believe, into thinking that this is normative in the way in which that's how austerity has been sold to us at this moment in time. It is. It's not an ideology. It's just the natural thing that needs to happen in order that we can change behaviour. It's interesting that I think it's a famous quote by Don Helder Camaro, who says that when you want to incentivize the rich, you pay them more. When you want to discipline the poor, you give them less. And that's almost become self-evident within Christian theology.
Yeah.
So we have a language for the undeserving poor, but you ever heard a language for the undeserving rich? So it's therefore it almost comes self-evidently easy to condemn the third servant, because clearly they're lazy. Clearly he's made bad choices, because don't poor people make bad choices all the time? I've sat and seen good Christians and say, but Anthony, I see how much money like they pay on lottery tickets. I see how much money they pay on fags and cigs, and how much money they pay on booze. Clearly, if we gave them more money, they would just waste it. So actually, maybe austerity has done them a favour, because it helps them to have better habits.
Yeah.
And as appalling as that sounds when I say it, let's not kid ourselves. As our friend and colleague said on the panel, a lot of church folk would vote for that on the basis that this is a way of regulating moral behaviour. And so we see the text in moral terms. Number two and number three are morally better than the third person. I want to reverse that. What Herzog says, and other people have said, is actually, maybe this is not a blueprint for how the kingdom is, it is a divine irony on an unjust system that Jesus recognised at the time that continues into our present day. This is not the kingdom, it's an ironic statement against the realities of the world that was first century Judea and 21st century Britain. That there is a fundamental truth. Those who have more will be given to them. That alongside austerity and the rampant poverty which we're speaking about, the rich have grown richer. Starting with the head start already, with more resources already accrued to them. And the poor, the fundamental truth in that last line, those, the little they have, even what they have will be taken from them. If we honestly believe that is a sign of the kingdom, then God help us. Literally, God help us. But actually, many of us would argue that what Jesus is offering is a divine irony. This is not the kingdom of God. Also, what we don't know is the tone of his voice and the look on his face when he was telling the story. Because all of us know that one of the ways irony works is that I can say something straight. I love you all. I have the utmost respect for you because I think you're all fantastic people. And depending on my voice and my tone, it may well be the fact I really can't stand you, but I'm just being polite. Irony doesn't transfer itself across time and space, because all we have is just the words. Out of this text, therefore, very quickly, as a way in which, for a whole set of parables, what Jesus is offering is a way for ordinary, dispossessed, first century people, often landless people in Judea, as a way of resisting. That the third person subverts the system by simply not doing what the system expects. Simply refuses to play a rigged game with resources that are set up for him to fail, because how can he possibly compete with what the other two have been already, given that his starting point is significantly less than? And we know from all the research shows that actually poverty is generational and is ongoing. That we have people who are not just poor because of what's happened in the last 10 years of austerity. They have been historically marginalised and dispossessed for the last 200 years in terms of liberal economics and global capitalism. So the rich get richer, and the poor, even the little they have, will be taken from them.